The Secrets of Star Trek is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit givestarquest.com. You're listening to The Secrets of Star Trek, where we discuss the hidden layers and deeper meanings found in all the Star Trek TV series, movies, and more. And today we're discussing the Next Generation episode, The High Ground. I'm Dom Bettinelli, and joining me today on the panel are Father Jason Tyler. Hey, Father.
Hello.
And Jimmy Akin. Hey, Jimmy.
Howdy, Dom.
Folks, be sure to stick around to the end of the episode. We'll have more of your great listener feedback. But first, Jimmy, can you give us a recap of what happens in The High Ground?
This week, the Enterprise goes to an independent planet where a bunch of separatists are using terrorism to try to get their independence. Beverly is kidnapped during a terrorist attack, and she meets the leader of the terrorists, a man named Carol Finn. You may know his cousin, Huckleberry. Finn is surprisingly sophisticated and makes shrewd points about politics and the Federation's role in the conflict. Meanwhile, Riker works with Susan Ivanova to try to find the terrorists. Susan is apparently slumming and doing Michael Garibaldi's job. The search for the terrorists is complicated by the fact that they're shifting between dimensions rather than using a transporter, and this dimension shifting is slowly killing them. But Wesley figures out how to track them. Before he does that, the terrorists attack the Enterprise to try to force the Federation into taking a more active role in the conflict so that they can use the Federation to force negotiations with the government. They try to destroy the ship but can't, so they kidnap Picard instead. By this point, Wes has figured out how to track them, so Riker takes a team and beams down, turns off the lights in the terrorist's cave, and conducts a rescue mission. Susan Ivanova shoots and kills Finn, and a kid with no lines is about to shoot her. But he puts down his gun when Beverly says to and is taken into custody, so we have a happy ending and nobody else dies. The end.
Father, what'd you think of this one?
I thought it was an okay episode, kind of middle of the road, but I thought it was one that had the potential to be a lot better. I mean, it has some good action sequences, I thought. It had a story that kept me interested, making me wonder, how is Dr. Crusher going to get out of this? What kind of help is she going to provide, etc.? And it seemed like, though, it wanted to say something about political terrorism, but I'm not really sure what, other than it's bad and it has a lot of bad effects on everybody. And yeah, as Jimmy pointed out, this boy that decides not to shoot had never said anything the whole episode, so we're not really emotionally connected to or invested in him. And so his decision not to shoot doesn't, have the same impact on the viewer, I think, as it would if he had been, you know, a more active character throughout the episode.
He's even listed in the credits as boy.
They don't even give him a name, huh?
Yeah, I didn't remember all the details of this one. I'm like, is that Finn's son? Which would have given it some weight.
Sure.
But they didn't do that. Jimmy, what'd you think of this one?
Well, I would put this above middle. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't put it in the top rank, but I'd probably give this a 7 out of 10. I thought I know that the producers of the show didn't like this one very much, precisely for the reason that Father Tyler said, that it's like, okay, we're doing an episode about terrorism, and all we have to say is terrorism bad. You know, they thought that they were at their best when, instead of proceeding, let's do a show about this issue, where they thought of, here's a cool science fiction concept or twist, and then they built the episode around that, and it might happen to deal with an issue, but it wasn't about the issue. And I recognize that, but I recognize that's normally the best way to go, but when you're doing episodic television, this was a nice shift from the high concept episodes that we normally have. I thought that there was a good bit of realism and darkness that we don't normally get in Next Gen. I thought that Finn was a really, and I called this out in my review, that in my summary, that he's just surprisingly sophisticated. And one of the things I like about the fact that it doesn't make a clear statement is because they're all making good points.
Right.
And it's not the Federation just didn't waltz in and get to be right about everything. Mm-hmm. Finn has good points. Susan Ivanova has good points. The people with the weakest points are actually the Enterprise crew. Mm-hmm. And so so I thought it was above average. I'd probably give it a 7. I thought it was not among the best episodes, but I would put it above middle of the road.
Yeah, I would have. Say that the characters of Alexana, who's
Alexana. I couldn't remember her name on the moment.
Yeah, it's so very close to Ivanova. Mm-hmm. It's just funny, and she looks like her. But the characters of her and Carol Finn are the most compelling aspects of this episode. I think their experiences that they relate and their characters are what save this and make it, I think, a little above average, like you say, Jimmy. And so. I agree with that. It's interesting. This is the second episode in a row in season 3 that's about terrorism. Because the last one we did in this season was The Hunted, about the super soldiers.
Oh, yeah.
And it's kind of interesting to me. They put these two right next to each other, which I would
that shows thought, they were desperate.
Yeah, yeah. The writer in this one is Melinda Snodgrass, who's one of the better writers. She's good, and she does really well with the characters that she builds in this, the unique characters. I also want to place this in its time. This came out in 1990, so I was trying to think, like, what terrorism are they commenting on here? Is it Intifada? Is it the Irish Troubles? Is it the Hezbollah in the Middle East? You know, that because all of those things were pretty relevant at the time in 1990, and there's elements of each of those. I mean. They named him Finn. That's
right. I thought that too. Like, okay, the name kind of points to me what conflict they're thinking about.
Apparently, Melinda Snodgrass wanted to, I think, make this about kind of the American Revolution, and she got a directive to make it more about Ireland.
Right.
And they even mention, and this is, interesting from our perspective in 2026. But at one point, Data and Picard are having a conversation about whether terrorism is effective. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it's not that great of a conversation overall.
Yeah.
But Picard mentions that terrorism was effective, or Data, I guess, maybe mentions that terrorism was effective in the Irish reunification of 2024.
Right. Right.
And consequently, they wouldn't let this episode be played in Ireland or in the UK.
Yeah. Right.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's in 1990. That would have been very controversial. yeah. Interesting. So looking at the how it all starts, the premise is a little shaky because I feel like it's a little shaky. Crusher puts herself into an imprudent situation right away. She orders Worf to go fetch medical supplies when his job is to stand there. And I'm thinking,
I kind of like one of the things she does. She says, I need bandages. I need this. I need something with alcohol in it.
Right.
And he goes and gets like a bottle of whiskey or something.
Yeah.
And I actually kind of like that detail, mm-hmm. but I know what you mean. Right. He needs to stand here and guard her.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
And, Picard's like, I have to beam you up right away. And Riker's like, I don't want to be in the transporter room. And I'm thinking, I have an idea. How about you beam her, the away team, and the injured to sick
yeah,
bay?
Yeah, exactly.
Because that doesn't violate any prime directives or anything. Right.
I also thought this was another entire episode that would not have existed if someone would have taken Worf's advice. So often, right? He suggests something and he gets shot down. Oh, we're not going to do that here. He's like, we need to get back to the ship. No, Lieutenant, we're staying here.
That's what I like about SG-1. Everybody takes Teal'c's advice.
Indeed. The other interesting thing is the kidnapper, the guy beams in, portals in, grabs her, and Worf and Data don't shoot. Like, he shoots one of the policemen, but why didn't you shoot him? It was very strange. You would think, Worf is a security man. He's primed. I know, you can be startled, but I don't know. Anyway.
And Data should not be startled. I mean, he should be able to react quickly enough. And
exactly.
And certainly can fire a phaser with full accuracy to hit his target that he needs. So,
yes, Data works like a robot at the convenience of plot, doesn't it?
By the way, another line I liked from this. So where they are at the beginning of the episode, they're like in a cafe down on the Independent Planet, and there's a bomb that goes off. And so Dr. Beverly is treating the victims of the bombing, and Worf and Data are with her, and they're concerned that there may be other terrorist things that are about to happen, you know, because that can be a terrorism tactic where you set off an initial problem. Mm-hmm. And then as emergency responders show up, you then set off a second problem.
Yeah.
And so they want to go back up to the ship, and they have this discussion as she's working on people of, you know, there are doctors on this planet, and she's like, they're not here, I am. And then they get on the phone to Picard, and he is encouraging them to beam up, and Picard points out to Beverly, she is endangering herself and the rest of the away team.
Yes.
And I like how she says Data and Worf don't have to stay.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't think that's a great solution, but I like the fact she makes that offer of I'm willing to stay here alone and do this. I'm not looking to endanger other crew members. Yeah. And then Picard finally gives Data orders to stay until the Rutian medics arrive.
Right.
By the way, I got to get that extra. It's Rutian, three syllables.
Yeah.
Because if it was just Rutan, it would be the green glowing squid jellyfish creatures from Doctor Who.
We have to be clear on that. There's a couple other good lines during after Crusher's abducted. They're in a briefing in the briefing room, and Riker says, you know, why do they do this? Their fight doesn't involve us. And Worf gets that great line. Mm-hmm. Does now.
It does now.
That is a good line.
That's the point. Mm-hmm. Also, Riker gets another line in there, which I thought was hilarious, because since they're using this dimensional shifting technology, it's untraceable. It's not like a transporter where you can detect a transporter trace, which they've already established. But Riker then gets this line that is so funny from an audience perspective. After they explain, you know, that we can't trace them and they don't yet know about the dimension shifting, Riker says, people don't just appear and disappear. There must be some way to track her. And I'm going, people don't just appear and disappear. It's like in your world, they do all the time.
Yeah. I mean, what we're talking about is just a different level of transporter. It doesn't seem like it should be that big of a concept leap in everyone's mind.
Right. Right. Not every transporter would have to work the same way necessarily.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was pretty funny. Well, another weird bit of dialogue was, you know, when they bring Wesley into the ready room to break the news that his mom's been kidnapped. Picard says they've taken him as a bargaining chip, and he's like, bargaining chip? And turns to Troy, who explains what I'm like, this kid's supposed to be brilliant. He doesn't know what a bargaining chip is.
I caught the same thing.
Has he read a book? That was kind of weird. Like, it was an awkward rhetorical device to explain a concept to the audience that the audience probably already knows.
Mm-hmm.
That was a weird moment to me.
Right. I did like the fact that they dealt with Wesley and in that same scene, you know, Picard says, we're going to go down and talk to the authorities and do our best to get him back. And Wesley appropriately says, I want to go.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and Picard appropriately for once says, actually, I have something I need you to do here. I need you to look into this weird transporter technology they've got so we can trace them.
Yeah.
And that does make sense, given who Wesley is.
Sure. Right. He's not just saying you can't go because you're a kid. He's saying, I have something for you to do. And that's a good moment for Picard and Wesley.
What I find interesting is later in the episode when Riker's leading an away team down to the surface and into combat and everything, Wesley doesn't ask again at that point. He says, I forget what he says, but it's more something along the lines of good luck or you know, bring hope it goes well or whatever. Yeah. He doesn't push it at that point. And I was wondering, was that some bit of growth where he's understanding like, okay, maybe I'm too emotionally connected at this point to jump into this and I'm not even going to ask again.
Right. I think he knows, you know, in a combat situation, mm-hmm. you know, he's not trained
in the same way. That's true. Yeah.
It would have been interesting to see him in relation to that other kid in that somehow, if they mm-hmm. somehow yeah. had him and the routine boy no was lines. Finn's kid. You're right. The boy without lines. And there was some sort of compare and contrast between them would have been an interesting addition. You know, Beverly's son versus Finn's son. I think that would have been an interesting moment. You know, we do get Finn talking about her Wesley later on and, mm-hmm. Oh, your son's aboard the ship. That's too bad. You know, that sort of thing. But that would have been interesting to see Wesley in that situation.
Yeah. By the way, I have a few notes on these terrorists. So first of all, they're called the Ansada, mm-hmm. which it just messes with me because Ansada is a Latin modifier that mm-hmm. means with handles. So like the Ankh, you know, the Egyptian symbol for uh-huh. life, mm-hmm. It's known in Coptic Christianity as well. It's known in Christianity. It's especially used as a symbol in Coptic Christianity, but it's known in Christianity as the crux ansata, the yeah. cross with a handle, huh. Because that loop on the top of the Ankh, you can hold it. So it's like a cross and it's got a handle. In fact, you even see pictures of Egyptian gods holding it like that.
Yeah.
But with the Ansada, I just think, oh, these are the terrorists with handles. Wow. When we finally get to where they to their base, it's this underground cave with no exterior access. Mm. And it's the most annoying environment to me because they've got all these little background beeps that sound just like my microwave and my security system and my phone. And I constantly am getting these little alert noises, but it's,
notice that.
It's just the background in this environment. Mm-hmm. Also, and this I think could be a writing flaw, but they establish that the Ansada have only been using this dimension jump technology for 2 months. Mm-hmm. And they've got all these people that they want Beverly Crusher to treat who have damaged their DNA irreparably by using this technology for 2 months. Mm. Meanwhile, the apparent leader of the Ansada is Finn, and he has some damage, but not as much. As not nearly apparently as much as the others. I mean, he's still ambulatory. He's walking around, not suffering any obvious, you know, grave damage. And it's like, okay, there's some interest in backstory here. Are you a terrorist leader who doesn't lead in the field? Oh, or are you a brand new terrorist leader? Or, you know, what's exactly going on here?
Yeah.
They never explain it, and it may not have even occurred to them, but if you've been only using this technology for 2 months and you've got all these super damaged people and you're the leader, but you're not one of them, what's up with that?
Oh, that doesn't surprise me.
I mean, I know Yasser Arafat or Osama bin Laden didn't lead in the field, but this is not quite that situation.
Right. I mean, we could headcanon it to say that certain people are affected in different ways, right? You know, some people have maybe a stronger natural immunity or stronger natural resistance than others. And so some people, you know, get afflicted, you know, in a very severe way quickly. And others, like maybe Finn, may take a long time to show the longer effects.
They could be couriers or people going out for supplies who jump more than others.
Right.
But although once you know that it's got these effects, you might move that around the people so that you don't lose people as quickly. But yeah, I mean, it's a good point. It's a question mark. Mm-hmm.
There is some interesting dialogue in this that, and I think the Federation comes off weakest of the dialogue. I think both, whatever her name is, Susan Ivanova and Finn get the better points. But like, there's one point where Finn is talking to Dr. Crusher and she's given him one of numerous lectures about, you know, terrorism bad. Mm-hmm. And he tells her she's an idealist. And her response is to say, I live in an ideal culture. And I'm going, yeah, duh. That's one of the big problems of this show. But she means it as, well, ideal cultures are possible. And yeah. I happen to live in one and you don't. But Finn still gets in good points about we're not where you are. And I've got to operate in the kind of culture I'm in. He then compares himself, and this may be a bleed through from Snodgrass's original intent for this, but he compares himself to George Washington. And here,
that's his weakest argument.
Yeah, because Washington was not known for killing innocents.
Right. He wasn't a terrorist.
And you know. and Finn's claim that the only difference between whether you get called a general or a terrorist, and actually you can be called both. But is whether you win or not. And I'm going, no, Washington did not target civilians.
Exactly.
There were terrorists in the American Revolutionary War, but Washington not only wasn't one of them, he actively tried to stop them from those actions. Yeah, they were there, but not Washington.
Data gets this in his conversation with Picard. He says, after reviewing how terrorism has been effective in the past, and I don't actually know how effective it's been. I mean, they cite the example of Mexico seceding from Spain. And that involving terrorism, and I don't know enough about that conflict to say how accurate that was. But Data, after he and Picard conclude that terrorism is often effective, whether that's true or not, Data then says, then would it be accurate to say that terrorism is acceptable when all options for peaceful settlement have been foreclosed? And Picard does this dodge line of, well, philosophers and people have been thinking about this for centuries, rather than give a direct answer. But just for the record, for anyone in the audience who's wondering, the answer is no. You cannot target civilians in order to achieve your political goals.
Well, and that's the thing, is that they don't actually define terrorism here. Terrorism is targeting civilian populations. A just war or a righteous war is between militaries. And you could have a guerrilla war that's just, but if you're targeting civilians, and there have been guerrilla wars that have succeeded where they've accomplished their ends, like, you know, independence or what have you.
Was ours.
Exactly. Yeah. Ours was at different points was a guerrilla war. It was also open war at another point. I think there's a little conflation going on in this in their discussions about what terrorism actually is. And it sort of goes like one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist. And I've always bristled at that adage because not necessarily. I mean, DS9 kind of falls into this a little bit with the same trope with the Bajorans.
Every rebellion is terrorism. I mean, you know, you can have rebellion that practices just war principles in terms of, you know, not targeting civilians and being proportionate in methods and everything else.
Right. And, you know, human nature being what it is, inevitably in war, there are those who act against the just war principles, and that happens. But, you know, that's a whole nother long discussion.
It's kind of like capitalism. It's like, just don't expect Hollywood writers to understand all this stuff.
Picard has a line. He says, history has shown that strength may be useless when faced with terrorism. And I kind of push back a little, but I also, there was some truth in that, which is
asymmetric warfare. Yeah.
Right. The U.S. experienced that in the, you know, the 80s and 90s and in well, frankly, the war on terror in Afghanistan and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. We are one of the most powerful nations on earth. But when faced with the Taliban in the mountains, we often had trouble. So there's some truth in that.
I do want to compliment, even though I think the Federation characters have some of the worst, lesser, weaker lines in this. I think Beverly has good acting in this. I think Gates McFadden and other actors are really doing a good job acting the lines they've been given.
Yeah.
some of the lines, the terrorists and well, the Rudians still get the best lines. Like there's a bit where Dr. Crusher and Finn, by the way, when she's first captured, the first thing Finn does in the cave, I meant to mention this, is he offers her food and she refuses to eat and refuses to speak. And she goes on like that for a while. And I'm like, what are you trying to accomplish by not eating or speaking?
Well, that's supposed to be the usual when you're a prisoner is you don't cooperate. You don't.
Yeah, but they should spell that out.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, the thing you see in old movies and TV shows, if an American soldier gets captured, he'll give name, rank and serial number and that's it.
Right. Yeah.
And they don't have an equivalent here.
Right. But we've seen that in Star Trek and other times. Think about Chekhov in The Search for Whales, right? Mm-hmm. He gets captured and he gives his name, his rank, his serial number, even in a situation where that was
meaningless.
Not a good idea at all. And it was meaningless. Exactly. And here it would have actually held some meaning and would have been more fully appropriate.
Chekhov, novel, Admiral.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. And actually telling your name and who you are and how you can be identified is important because for negotiations.
Right.
They need to know who they're holding so they can negotiate release. But anyway, there's so she and Finn later on are having this conversation and they're talking about terrorism and Dr. Crusher says, is that the best you can do? Is fear the only weapon you have? And Finn gets the best line. Nope, but it's a good one.
It is. I want to go back to the Rutian security chief, Alexana, and she. When she's talking with Riker, she calls the terrorists, she calls them animals who kill without remorse. And yet we see Finn being kind to Beverly. He even has a crush on Crusher, drawing pictures of her.
In fact, and it's also reciprocal. She starts to have a crush on him. And we have hints of Stockholm syndrome here.
Yes.
Which Picard even alludes to.
Right.
But it never, she never tips over into I'm in love with this terrorist, which is good.
Yes. Yeah.
In fact, at the end, she tells Picard, I've got some things I want to tell you in case we don't get out of this. And she's about to confess her feelings for him. And just then the lights go out and the rescue mission happens.
Right. Picard's like, don't.
but the fact that that she never completely falls for Finn is good because that's a trope that we've seen in this show too many times.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I think speaking of Finn, well, actually, I want to go back to the Rutian security chief. She talks about how what motivates her. Like she's first. I'm better than my predecessors. You know, we do roundups, but we don't torture people like we like they, those guys did. And her perspective comes from the fact that, you know, the bomb, not suicide. That's a whole, another point I want to make. But the bomb that blew up the bus that killed the children aboard it. And she's like, in a world where children blow up children, everyone's a threat. She talks about they arrested a little kid. And that's also an example from the real world where terrorists have used children as their couriers for bombs. So I thought that was interesting to show, like, yes, she's reasonable. Finn's reasonable. They're both reasonable. They have points that they're making. You know, one of them is wrong. Maybe they're both wrong, but they're both also have reasonable points. And that shows the complexity of these sorts of situations. There is not a clear, like, who's right and who's wrong. And that's, I think, one of the things that makes this story better than most. It doesn't draw a black and white line.
Also, Finn has a complex multi-stage plan that has actually been well thought out about how we're going to drag the Federation into this.
Yeah.
We're there because they perceive the Federation, since they have a trade relationship with the Rudian government, they perceive the Federation as already having taken sides.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And now they want them to directly engage this conflict. The way Finn puts it, you've already put a seat at the table. Now I'm making you sit in it.
Right.
And then The Federation will initially, you know, side with the Rudian government, but they're not going to have the stomach for a long term conflict. And so that's going to inevitably result in the Federation putting pressure on the government to negotiate with us. And we'll get concessions and we'll get a few more concessions. And then we'll announce a peace agreement that saves face for everybody.
Right.
But we win.
Right.
And it's like, OK, this has been seriously thought out. Yeah. Here. This is not just cartoon supervillains on a sci-fi show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I really like that aspect of it. Like this is this is a guy who has a plan. He's executing the plan. Do you think he's right? The Federation, by supplying medical supplies to the routine government, they think, oh, there's this bad situation going on. They need medical help. We're going to give it to them. But by doing that, have they taken a side? Is it essentially taking a side?
If they are supplying medical supplies for a conflict to only one side of that conflict, I'd say, yeah.
Yeah.
But is it only medical supplies that they're giving, or is it a broader trading relationship? Because there was a couple of mentions, I think, at different points about that.
Yeah,
right?
They say they've had the now the Rudy the Rudian lady says that this war has been going on for 70 years. But they do describe the Federation as having a trading relationship, and I would assume that's broader than just the medical supplies. Yeah. They may also be giving them weapons, low grade weapons technology. But if you're helping one, even if they have a broader relationship, if you're giving stuff for a conflict to one side of the conflict, you've taken sides whether you realize that or not.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, as part of the trading relationship, the Rudians could have just said, hey, by the way, could we get some medical supplies from y'all? And just routinely, oh, you want medical supplies? Sure, we'll trade for that. And and nobody thought about it, but you've taken sides right there.
Sure. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The other point I was going to make was the dimension shifting device is essentially kind of a suicide bomb. It's the sort of an equivalent in the sense of, in order to deliver their weapons to carry out their attacks,
they're doing things which will kill them.
I thought that was an interesting analogy. It's somewhat subtle analogy, but I think that's an interesting one.
Not as direct as the suicide bombs on Battlestar Galactica. Those were real suicide bombs.
Right.
Yeah, this is a very slow acting suicide bomb.
Yes. So another thing, criticism of that Finn makes of the Federation, because, you know, he talks about how, you know, your history involves wars of aggression and the destruction of whole cities, and your ideal society that Beverly claimed is built on that legacy. And now you get to enjoy the fruits of that violence. But now you do. But even so, you frown on my immorality. And it's an interesting argument he's making. He's basically saying, like, you get to have a peaceful, ideal society because you defeated all your enemies in the past using wars of aggression. And now you deny that to us. You know, that opportunity. I think it's an interesting argument. Does it hold water?
Oh, yeah. Beverly and the other Federation people are reaping the benefits of a long, bloody process that and then lording it over people who are still in the midst of that process. Now, that doesn't justify what the specific things Finn's doing. But they do have this tenderfoot morality that, or tenderfoot set of mores, I would better say, that people who have to deal with real life and actual problems don't have the same luxuries.
Right. Right.
In fact, we tend to have something like that going on today. Where people in affluent countries like the United States can have this tenderfoot set of mores that that people in history would not have had, and they're too quick to judge people in other circumstances that are having to deal with factors we no longer have to worry about.
Right, judging people in history and and today, present day as well. That's true. Riker eventually gets to the point where he says, we, the Federation, are now willing to negotiate for Crusher's release. He basically says, we're going to negotiate, to the consternation of the Rutian security chief, but she's like,
just call her Susan. You know, Susan. You want to
call Susan. And she kind of goes on because like she's tired of all the violence and killing too. Like she's like, oh, you know, we'll try it your way because, you know, what could it hurt at this point? So that was an interesting aspect of it. Of course, the answer to that is the attack on the Enterprise. It's mm-hmm. lucky that the Enseta bomb that mm-hmm. they put on the warp drive didn't explode instantly after they left. Mm-hmm. They gave them a timer.
Yeah.
Like, why would you bother? Just have it as soon as I'm gone, blow up, because that's my goal, is to turn the Enterprise into a dust cloud. Like,
And it seems like Geordi knew there was a timer on it, right? I mean, because in the whole way that sequence plays out, he's knocked down or whatever. He's behind a console and he sees the terrorist, you know, getting near the warp core, and he stays and you watch. And of course, Geordi's unarmed. The terrorist has a weapon. So maybe he's thinking, I'm not going to be able to stop him anyway. My best shot is just to, you know, see if he's going to do something and then step away from it. And then, you know, he can do, you know, what he did and, you know, pull the bomb off and put his communicator on it and have it beamed out into space. But
we can't have the Enterprise destroyed, but you know, right. This is what we do. It was interesting, by the way, in Picard, one of Picard's many speeches, he says something about the power flowing, political power flowing from the barrel of a gun. He's quoting Mao in that moment. I looked it up. Mao actually used that a couple times, but the first time was in 1927. But it was not approving. He wasn't saying it in an approving way, but he's just saying we have to show that power doesn't flow from the a barrel of a gun. And so I found it interesting, Picard quoting Mao. So Picard gets kidnapped after the explosion fails to. They must have had.
Well, plans for this. This is Star Trek, so I assume that Picard has a copy of Chairman Mao's little red book that he reads all the time
in their little socialist federation. Finn clearly had a backup plan when the bomb didn't destroy the Enterprise. Was to, okay, if I can't blow up the Enterprise, I'll kidnap the captain. So he shows up and takes Picard. I think that's an interesting moment there. Mm-hmm. So we have this interesting scene where Crusher and Picard, she first sees him, and he's telling her, if you'd only obeyed orders, none of this would have happened, which is true. Mm-hmm. And then she says, if you would give reasonable orders, and it's like, I'll be the judge of what's reasonable. I'm the captain. And he's right. Mm-hmm.
I love how close, or how may not even be close, but I love the insubordination there.
Yes.
If you gave reasonable orders, I'd obey.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. That's not how that works.
Right. You know, at one point, too, during that conversation, he starts telling her all the things that they've discovered on the Enterprise, you know, all the things they've learned about the dimensional shifts and everything. And one thought I had was like, how does he know their conversation's not being monitored by their captors?
Same thing.
People in TV prison never think of that.
Yes. The last time we talked to us with the Enterprise, the communicator, they're in the jail talking to each other about stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we've been monitoring people in jail for ages. I mean, when the two guys who got kidnapped in the Pascagoula UFO abduction, Calvin Parker and Charles Hickson, they were in prison or jail. They were at the they were in the police station. They weren't in jail. And the police were monitoring them, you know, secretly. So,
if your lawyer's not there, they're listening.
I do like, part of Picard's dialogue in this scene where he's telling Beverly about what's been going on up on the ship. And he says, he's describing the battle that just happened, and he says, Worf went down. I don't know if he's dead or alive. There were other casualties. And Crusher says, was Wes on the bridge? And Picard says, yes, he took cover. I didn't see anything more than that.
Yeah.
And I like how he's relating this information. I don't know if Worf is alive or dead. I saw your son duck, but I don't know what happened to him. That's nice writing. I like that.
Yeah. And later, when she's kind of defending Finn, he's like, Beverly, you're defending a man who may have just killed your son.
Yeah.
Like, and that's the shocking moment for her that kind of flips the switch back for her, which is good. I like that.
Fortunately, Finn shows up at that moment and says, I didn't kill him.
Right. Finn does use these casually shocking statements to keep Crusher off balance throughout it. Like, they'll be talking, it's like, and he'll stop and just go, I may have to kill Picard. Like, it just, and it's an interesting tactic that he's using on her.
I took that as sincere. It's like, because he's thinking as tactically, I'm likely to have to kill this guy.
Right.
And I don't, and I like Beverly. I mm-hmm. don't want her to be caught off guard when that happens.
Right.
So I'm going to tell her about it. And she then argues that Picard can be flipped in some way. I'm not exactly sure how. I mean, you know, what he would do. But, and Finn says, not by me, you may be able to talk to him, but it's not going to come from me.
Right. And that's when she ends the conversation. You know, what scares me most is that you would actually get real power after all this. And that's when he reveals that he's been drawing her and he's got a crush on her and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And
he gives her the sketchbook and she immediately takes it to Picard and Picard's reaction is, we can use this. It's like you got Finn and Picard both figuring out how when Beverly's caught in the middle of how to use who. Right.
Finn has a line that he uses on Picard, which is good. He says, Captain, the Federation has a lot to admire in it, but there's a hint of moral cowardice in your dealings with non-aligned planets. You're doing business with a government that's crushing us and you say you're not involved. Again, a valid point.
and Picard then like rebukes him for accusing the Federation of moral cowardice. And I'm like, okay, I like the fact the terrorist acknowledges the Federation has stuff to admire.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
He's not just I hate you because you're allied with our enemies. Mm-hmm. So Finn is again a thoughtful guy. And Picard comes across as having a glass jaw if he can't take a little criticism of moral cowardice after an admission by a terrorist. You've got a lot to admire.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. He's a little sensitive on that subject. Mm-hmm. So the attack on the Rutian, the Ansada base is interesting. If I were the Rutian security, I would beam in not four people, a dozen, two dozen.
Right. Yeah.
Speaking of the tactics they use in this battle where they turn off the lights, there are a couple of interesting things about this. One of them is the battle is almost entirely silent.
Yeah.
In terms of there is like no dialogue.
Yep.
During this battle. And that's interesting. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I find really interesting is we see a tactic used that is never used again.
I was going to bring that up. Yeah.
Right at the beginning of the battle, this is how they get access to, I guess, where they can turn the lights off. A Rutian security agent and Worf walk up to these two guys who are minding these controls or whatever. And inject them to sleep.
Yes. Some kind of stunner or something. Yeah.
They like put this thing on their neck and you hear the sound of a hypospray and they both go down. And I'm like, wow, Worf, hyposprays are honorable, I guess.
Well, I mean, when you have to, it's better than, you know, more compatible with the Federation morals than the usual knife across the throat thing that the commandos would do.
Yeah, but still, I mean, normally on this show, they'd get zapped.
Right. And a phaser makes noise.
With a phaser. And here we get to see something different. And I liked it just for being different.
I kind of mentioned, like, why don't we ever see this again? Because it's a great tool to use whenever you need to be silently disable an enemy. But I have that moment where Finn rushes in. He's got the pistol pointed at Picard. He's
about hesitates. To kill him.
Yeah, he does hesitate.
Mm-hmm.
And Beverly jumps up. And when she sees the Rutian Susanna Ivanova behind him and doesn't warn him. And that is a key moment that doesn't get, you know, a big, you know, spotlight shown on it. Yeah. I like the fact that we see it. We know it. They respect us enough not to have to spell it out for us what she did. Mm-hmm. And he dies in that moment. That is an interesting bit of directing there. I like that.
I like this kind of moment in a show where you communicate something powerful just through looks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like at the end of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, where you've got the 8-minute standoff.
Right.
with no dialogue, and it's all looks and stuff, and it's riveting. Recently, I'm doing a rewatch right now of SG-1, and there's this episode with Rene Auberjonois in it,
yes,
as Space Hitler's son.
Great episode.
And yeah, and at the end of that, they're coming back to Stargate Command, and they've abandoned the Space Hitler people, and Rene Auberjonois is begging to come, and he's like, I can teach you everything I know about all this advanced tech. And O'Neill has previously said, don't follow us, but he knows Rene Auberjonois is going to follow him.
Yeah.
And he and Samantha Carter go through the gate back to Earth. And even though it's technically, you could argue this is procedure, he knows Rene Auberjonois is going to come, and he still says, close the iris, which means as soon as Rene Auberjonois steps through, he's going to be annihilated.
Yeah.
And so the iris closes, and you hear the thump as Rene Auberjonois dies, and nobody in Stargate Command realizes the significance, but Jack just killed that guy.
Right.
And the only person who recognizes it is Sam, and yeah, she's looking back at Jack, and she just has this horrified expression on her face and doesn't say anything. And that's the end of the episode. And it's like, wow, that's cold. I mean, he just murdered this guy, and Sam knows it.
Yep.
All conveyed through looks.
Right. You don't have to spell everything out to the audience. So Beverly saves the boy who's pointing the gun at Ivanova. And she says, maybe after that, I think she says, maybe the end begins with one boy putting down his gun. I said, Beverly, yeah,
right. Riker says that.
Right. Like, cause the security chief, she's like, oh, you know, we have to arrest another kid. And he, you know, and so the cycle continues. And he says, well, maybe the cycle ends with putting, you know, one boy putting down his gun, and which is a decent, a moral to end on. As the episode finished, I was thinking to myself, what should the Federation do now? Like, what is the Federation's response? Do they
try to negotiate? Somebody else's problem. We get to leave orbit. I mean,
morally, I feel like they should negotiate a peace here. They should try to come in and bring the two sides to the table, and you know, because they've been involved. They've mm-hmm. gotten involved. So I thought that was just thinking about that I would
suspect Finn achieved his overall goal. The Federation can't let things continue the way they were. The logical response is now for the Federation to go in and insist on negotiations. If you want to have trade relations with mm-hmm. us, you're going to have to negotiate. Right. If you don't want to negotiate, we're going to sever trade relations.
Yeah. Yeah, the Enterprise was not destroyed, but they said 3 or 4 crew members were killed in the attack. And so there's, you know, Federation blood has been spilled. You can see where that's going to get people's attention probably to get involved in some way.
The security chief, she had an interesting comment, too, after she kills Finn. She says, you know, as a prisoner, he would have been a focus for violence mm-hmm.
Now he's a martyr.
He's become a martyr. There was no clean solution to that.
Mm-hmm. The line, I like that one, so I copied it from the transcript. She says, so she's just shot Finn, and Riker says, you didn't have to kill him. And she responds, as a prisoner, he would have been a focus for violence as his followers tried to free him. So that's why she killed him. Now he's a martyr, but the death toll might go down, at least in the short term. It's an imperfect solution for an imperfect world.
Mm. Right. That's a very good line to end that with. Any other thoughts on this, Father?
No, we covered all my notes.
How about you, Jimmy?
Picard did get another nice line at a couple of them. He's talking with Beverly in private. I keep calling her Beverly in this. It's because that's the main name she's referred to by in this episode. Yeah. Nobody calls her Dr. Crusher.
Yeah.
But she comes back to him, and he said, in where he's laying down, and he says, Beverly, how dangerous would another ride through that inverter be to us? And her being a doctor, she says, I don't know, but I don't want you to start thinking about, and he cuts her off and says, Beverly, it is our obligation to think of escape. Mm-hmm. And she says, he's prepared to kill you. And he says, an excellent reason to escape.
I was already planning to escape. You don't have to sell me on the idea.
By the way, one visual note on this. They have, and I think there's a little variation in this. I think that, but in, they have a nice, some nice visual coding or to tell us this is an alien race. The men Rudians all have like black hair, and the women Rudians have like middle brown hair. But in addition to that, the men on the left side of their head in their black hair have a white streak.
Yeah.
And they've all got this white skunk streak.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the women in their middle brown hair have a dark brown streak on the right.
Yeah.
So it's like men have the left streak, women have the right streak.
And which may be a cultural thing or genetic or something. Yeah.
I assume genetic since everybody's got it.
Yeah.
But it's alien coding to tell us they're alien. Yeah. And I like that.
At least
I like
it's not head bumps.
It's something. Yeah. It's something different, and it's something that was easy to do, and they never made a point of it. It's not like, so, Mr. Data, what should we know about these people? Well, all of the men have a white streak in their black hair on the left, and all the women have a dark brown streak in their middle brown hair on the right.
Right.
Thank you. I'm sure that will become important to the plot later.
I have to say, after discussing this with you, with both of you, it feels like my estimation of this episode does go up even a little more, but it was good. Had its flaws, but it was more good than bad.
Apparently, it was part of a request from someone, maybe the studio, but to have more action episodes, and this one is more action oriented.
Right.
It is not as high concept, and I like that as a break. Mm-hmm. I think we need a mix.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's High Ground. Moving on to listener feedback. This feedback comes from our recent episode from Enterprise, the communicator. Sir Cadzalot wrote on YouTube, it's interesting to have a sort of historical episode without it being actual history. That being said, I'd like to see.
Welcome to Doctor Who.
Yeah, I was gonna say, true historicals. Oh, the thing I've always wanted more from Doctor Who. That being said, I'd like to see more planets which took a different technological route than we did, like leapfrog fossil fuels right into nuclear power, or computation without discovering electricity. You can do a lot if you get to choose what resources your planet has to start with.
And an example of that is Larry Niven's Ringworld series. The Ringworld is an artificial construct, and that means it has no fossil fuels. And so all the cultures on Ringworld, as they developed, had to go from caveman directly to alcohol-fueled engines. Mm. And so they skip the petroleum stage altogether because there's no petroleum on Ringworld.
Right, right. Mm. That would be interesting. I'd like to see more of that.
Yeah.
And then Wasteland DV8092 also writes on YouTube, when I was in the Army, we had a sensitive items check all the time to make sure we didn't lose anything. So, yeah, they should have checked a few times before they went back. I think you meant back to the ship. Mm-hmm. The cloaking device in that episode worked the same way as the Klingon one in Star Trek IV. There's a scene in that movie where they open the door and all you see is a bright square that they walk out of, which is true. Yeah, so but I think they established that the cloaking device that the Suliban have came from the future. I think that was established earlier on, so I think that's why they have such an enhanced cloak.
Maybe.
Yeah. All right, so that's our feedback. Thank you both. We really appreciate it. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create the Secrets of Star Trek, including George S., Joseph J., Alexander S., Lewis M., and Adam H. Their generous donations at GiveStarQuest.com make it possible for us to continue the Secrets of Star Trek and all the shows at StarQuest, and you can join them by visiting GiveStarQuest.com. And also, be sure to get your very own Secrets of Star Trek t-shirt or other merchandise by visiting SQPN.com/merch. And so that's it from us this time. We'd love to know what you thought of The High Ground. Let us know by commenting on the show at sqpn.com/trek. Send us an email to trek@sqpn.com. Visit our Discord community at sqpn.com/discord, or watch The Secrets of Star Trek on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/starquestmedia. We'll be back next time, where we'll be discussing the Deep Space Nine episode Return to Grace. Until then, Jimmy Akin, thank you for joining me and sharing The Secrets of Star Trek.
Thank you, and live long and prosper.
And Father Jason Tyler, thank you as well.
Thanks, Dom.
And once again, I'm Dom Bettinelli. Thank you for listening to The Secrets of Star Trek on StarQuest. And remember, you should be drawing, not killing people. Here's another show on the StarQuest Network you're sure to enjoy. The Secrets of Sacred Art. Find it wherever fine podcasts are found or at starquest.fm/art.